As you know, our theme text is Hebrews 12:1. A portion of the text is on the banner behind me. I want to read you several translations, and as I read them, I trust that you will sort of notice the different ways in which the particular translators have presented the thought that I'm sure the Apostle Paul had in mind when he wrote this verse. The King James first, of course. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. And then reading from the 20th century, seeing that there is on every side of us such a throng of witnesses, let us therefore in our turn lay aside everything that hinders us and the sin that clings about us, and run with perseverance the course that lies before us. Then the Williams translation, therefore, as we have so vast a crowd of spectators in the grandstands, let us throw off every impediment and the sin that easily entangles our feet, and run with endurance the race for which we are entered. The Amplified, which I rather like to think of being the emphasized version. Therefore then, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses who have borne testimony of the truth, let us strip off and throw aside every encumbrance, unnecessary weight, and that sin which so readily, in parenthesis, deftly and cleverly, clings to and entangles us, and let us run with patient endurance and steady and active persistence the appointed course of the race that is set before us. That is almost a discourse in itself. And then, lastly, J.B. Phelps. Surrounded then as we are by these serried ranks of witnesses, let us strip off everything that hinders us, as well as the sin which dogs our feet, and let us run the race we have to run with patience. Now, you'll notice that translation has a word that I imagine most of us are not familiar with. I know I wasn't until I read it. Serried. And it means compacted in rows or ranks as soldiers in company formation. It's taken from the word serry, which means pressed close together in ranks. And I read you these different translations. Each translation seems to have a particular appealing point in regards to the general thought in this particular verse. Then also there are some points in the translations that have a weakness. The King James, as we all know, is really our basic Bible. That's the Bible that we always start out with before turning to more modern translations for, in many cases, better expressions and clearer statements. However, in the King James text, we find the opening words of this particular verse a very misleading statement when we analyze it. But I think that we have read it so many times with the proper thought in mind that we perhaps fail to recognize the incorrectness of that opening statement. And you know, the King James is universally accepted, and because of that, our helps, our concordances, our lexicons, and our Bible dictionaries are based upon its wording. I suppose some of you have heard the story of the young man that was a Bible salesman, and he was going around to the countryside visiting the farms and trying to sell a new version of the Bible that he had. Very beautiful thing, gilt edges and nice Moroccan leather and fine India paper, and he was talking to this one farmer about it and explaining it to him, and the farmer says, well, now I understand that the King James Bible is the oldest Bible we have. And the young fellow says, well, yes, this was one of the first translations. And the farmer says, well, frankly, son, I'll tell you, if the King James was good enough for our Lord and the Apostle Paul, it's good enough for me. Now, going back to what I mentioned earlier, notice in the opening words of the King James the statement, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. The word also is not proper, because Paul is referring, of course, to those that he mentioned in the previous chapter in Hebrews 11, that last that we call the ancient worthies, and seems to indicate by the way it reads that they also had a cloud of witnesses about them, but they did not, except as they may have been aware of those contemporary with them in their endeavors to serve the Lord faithfully and to do His will, and then what knowledge they might have had of several generations before them. The we also, Vincent, in his word study of the New Testament, suggests that the also, or we also, should be with, let us run, which would change the thought to this, therefore let us also run as they did, with patience the race that is set before us. Now, in this instance, in this text, the word witnesses does not mean spectators. Now, when we think of somebody being a witness, that's the first thing we think of somebody being a spectator or seeing something or witnessing something. But it's really being used to refer to those, as we well know, who have already borne witness, who have been witnesses in their activity, have borne witness to the truth, the ancient worthies. Paul devotes an entire chapter. He names a number of them, and then, realizing that it wasn't necessary to name them all, he tells of their various experiences in that 11th chapter. As I mentioned earlier, I do believe that Paul wrote the epistle to the Hebrews. There has some doubt among some of the theologians and some commentaries as to the authenticity of the author, but I believe that it was the Apostle Paul, because of what he has in there and the familiarity with the types and shadows of the Old Testament, his reference to the New Covenant, and so on. He's not writing in this particular verse as though the ancient worthies were looking down upon us from the heavens and watching and witnessing every move. This we know is not possible, because with the words with which he closes the concluding closes of previous chapter, when he mentions that they were promised a better resurrection, but then he says that they without us should not be made perfect. Without the completion of the church, they cannot receive the fulfillment of that promise of a better resurrection. When the church is complete and other things are accomplished, the first to benefit from the application of the ransom and the arrangement of the new covenant, we believe the ancient worthies will have that perfect resurrection. Now, our text deals with this group, these ancient worthies, as being a cloud of witnesses. Their experiences, their acts of faith, their service to the Lord are examples for us. But I want to deal for a few moments with a more modern cloud of witnesses. I'm going to digress from the text for just a moment, and when I'm through, you may say, well, Brother Penrose didn't cover the subject very well, but you know, I have some brethren that are going to back me up. If you've looked ahead on the program, you'll notice that on Monday, we have Brother Tim Krupa. He's going to have the subject, Cloud of Witnesses, taken from this text. On Tuesday, Brother Chandler is going to have The Weight That Besets Us. On Wednesday, Brother Langford will have the text, Run With Patience. And on Thursday, Brother Hersher, The Race Before Us. So I think that by Thursday evening, we will have covered the text quite thoroughly. You know, on your name tags, it states that this is the 50th convention, the 50th Bible Student Convention. Now, when it started in 1939, it was not known as the Bible Students General Convention. It was called the Midwest Convention. And the first convention was held at a place called Lake Webster. That was 50 years ago. Now, I'm going to ask you if all of you, or the few of you, I probably should say, that attended that first convention, how many of you were there? Ray and Bernie. Leo Pogues, Sister Stalker, very few. Now, let me ask you something else. How many have attended all 50 of them? Henrietta, Ray, and Bernie. Yes, good. Now, I want to say something else. Brother and Sister Krupa held up their hand as having attended all 50. This would be a golden convention for them. But they also, this year, and just recently, celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. So they have had 50 years together in convention and in marriage. And I think, and I say this not in jest, but I say it as a compliment, there we have a good example of patient endurance. Over the years, over the 50 years, this convention has been held at Chautauqua, Ohio. We were there for a few years. One year we were in Brooklyn, New York. Then we went back to Chautauqua, Ohio. We had several years in Bowling Green, Ohio. A number of years in Bloomington, Indiana. Then Bowling Green, Kentucky. Grand Rapids, Michigan. Calvin College in Grand Rapids. Albion, Michigan, we were there a number of years, and then last year at Chattanooga, and this year at Chattanooga. I have 1990 here, but I don't have a name after. We'll have to decide that at the business meeting Wednesday. Now, over the years, we have fellowshipped and been taught and given lessons by many brethren that we learn to love because of their faithfulness. And I just want to mention a few of them. You'll call them to mind, and each one, as I remember, had their own little, not necessarily peculiarity, but the thing that stood out in their character and in their way of presenting themselves. There was Brother George Wilson, Norman Woodworth, Brother Pollock, Brother Fay, Brother Zeno, Brother McCauley, three Bakers, Sam Baker, W.A. Baker, and W.T. Baker, Robert Krebs, Chester Sunbaum, Claude Wyda, Brother Dyfer, Irving Foss, Bill Birchie, George Yike, the Elder. There was Charlie Chupa, Horace Blinn. I could go on. I don't dare take that much time, or I'll be criticized for it, I'm sure. But you remember those brethren. You remember the lessons they gave us and the faithfulness that they exhibited in their service to the Lord and to the convention. Now, I'm sure that, as I have mentioned some of these, you have called to mind perhaps those that were your favorites and the ones from which you derived the most blessings from in their service and in their teachings. There was Paul Davis, Russell Jurd, John Hall, Harry Patius, Harry Hersher, Brother Swanson. What was his first name? I can't think. Fine. And then the two Copelands, Don Copeland, Jens Copeland. If you remember Jens Copeland, his peculiarity was punctuality. If the meeting was to start at 7:30, it started at 7:30. There was Ken Nail, Everett Murray, Brother Wylam, Harold Ellis, Brother Birchie. Yes, any number of them. We could go on and on. And I'm sure, as I said, you have your favorites, the ones that you have called to mind. You know, history and tradition tells us that the Apostle Paul was small of stature and perhaps frail in appearance, but in appearance only. He was really a sturdy and a man of stamina when we read of the many things that happened to him, that he endured in the Lord's service for the 30 years or better that he was in the Lord's service. Now, I like to think that Paul, because of the illustrations he gives us throughout his writings, must have been, and perhaps more so because physically he couldn't partake of these particular activities, that he was athletically inclined and very sports-minded. Perhaps secretly he might have enjoyed taking part in some of the sports of his day. The Grecian Olympian Games of that day, which now we call the Olympics, held every 4 years. And Paul's interest and knowledge of them is shown by the number of times he draws upon those contests for illustrations. The games at that time consisted mostly of foot races, not short distances, but races of endurance, wrestling, and boxing. And he refers in his illustrations to those three activities in particular. He draws upon them as illustrations and lessons for us. In our text in Hebrews 12:1, as we read it, we could form in our minds a stadium and the crowds watching, the runners in the race. Let us run with endurance the race which we have entered. And the races at that time, as I mentioned, were mainly races of endurance, of long distance, not short sprints. And, of course, there were other qualifications to have a part in those races. Paul, in 1 Corinthians, I don't have the chapter down. That's terrible. But I have the verses, 24 through 20. You recognize them when I read them to you. I beg your pardon?
Chapter 9.
Fine, thank you. 1 Corinthians 9:24-27. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize, so run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air. Now here he has introduced two activities, running and also fighting or boxing. But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. In 1 Timothy 6:12, he urges us to fight the good fight of faith. And then of himself, he wrote in 2 Timothy 4:7, I have fought a good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith. In the early Olympics, only men participated. In fact, it's stated that in many of the contests they had, that women were not even allowed as spectators. It was strictly a man's sport. And in laying aside any and everything that might hinder the runner, some of them would run perhaps without any clothing at all in order that they might get the best results from their efforts. There was nothing in the way of covering that would offer resistance to their efforts. And Paul, applying the lesson for us, has suggested that we lay aside every weight or hindrance that might hold us back. Now, this is an illustration. It's not something we should take literally. And the weight or hindrance varies with each of us. You have to decide in your own situation, under your own conditions, your own surroundings, your own association, just what it is that might be the weight or the weights that are hindering you in your service to the Lord and the carrying out of your covenant of sacrifice. It could be habits. It could be your work, your environment, whatever might touch you and affect you. If we could be free of all these encumbrances, devote all of our time to service, to developing character, praying always, as we are urged to do, that would be the ideal condition, wouldn't it? But this we can't do. We have our responsibilities. We have our responsibilities to our family. We have our responsibility to our work or whatever activity we might be engaged in. And so we must live up to those responsibilities. But we also should make sure that some of those are not weights that could be laid aside and would not hinder us. Some we cling to that could really be laid aside, that we could do away with and not be hindered by them. No doubt in each of our cases there are many, but you each must decide what it is that you can lay aside, what weight it is. You may not recognize it at the time as a weight, as a hindrance. whatever you could cast aside and lay aside in order that you might the more successfully run this race is, of course, to your advantage. That you could run the race more zealously, diligently, and with less encumbrance, and exercising patient endurance all the while. Paul, in his illustrations, always sets before us the ideal condition, knowing full well that we cannot measure up to it. But he urges us to strive to do the best we can to measure up to those qualifications. Now, Paul realized this very failure in himself. As we read his writings, we can see it's quite evident that he was inclined to frequently analyze himself and his own situation. And then he would use this analysis to demonstrate his point. Notice what he wrote in 2 Corinthians 13:5. Examine yourselves, whether ye be in the faith. Prove your own selves. Know ye not your own selves, how that Jesus Christ is in you, except ye be reprobate. Now, Paul, as I said, did examine himself. And here's what he wrote as a result of that examination. And as I read these words to you, this is only a portion of what he wrote in relation to this, but think of it in relation to your own experiences and yourself. It's Romans 7. I want to read the 18th through the 22nd verses. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, and how to perform that which is good I find not. For the good that I would, I do not. But the evil which I would not, that I do. Isn't that true with us? How often we start out to do the proper thing, and we find ourselves doing the wrong thing. Now, if I do that, I would not. It is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. I find the law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man. And as I mentioned a moment ago, how true that is with us. The thing then that we would do, sometimes we fail to do, and we find ourselves doing the things that we would not do. That would not be in harmony, is not in harmony with our consecration, with our vow, and so on. We would like to do better, and I'm sure we strive to do better. Let me illustrate that by this. And I'm sure you've all had this experience. Let me start out by telling you what a sister told me one time. She said at night when she's trying to fall asleep and she can't fall asleep for some reason or another, she says in her mind she can give one of the best discourses on the divine plan that you would ever want. How many times have you thought what you were going to say to somebody? Perhaps it's a tense situation and you word it in your mind just the very thing you're going to say. It's perfect. It's going to put that person in their place. And then when you start to say it, it doesn't come out that way, does it? Even when we're here on the platform, what we intended to say when we came up here, and I think all the elders who speak from the platform will agree with me, it doesn't always come out the way we think of it before we reach the platform. I'm finding that my own experience right now. In the King James, and the sin which doth so easily beset us. In the Williams we read, the sin that easily entangles our feet. And in Phillips, and I like this, but I wonder if Paul really intended this, as well as the sin which dogs our feet. Have you ever had the experience of a little dog snapping at your heels, at your feet? I think that's what Phillips had in mind. Whether Paul had that in mind, I don't know. But it's a good illustration. Now, in our text, after referring to the various hindrances and encumbrances in general, he writes of a specific one and seems to suggest that it is more dangerous than any other. Yet he doesn't identify it, but leaves a strong suggestion as to what he has in mind by what he has written about it in the previous chapter, in chapter 11. There seems to be little doubt that the sin which dogs our feet or which so easily besets us, is what? The sin of unbelief. A lack of faith. or a failure to exercise faith, because he's devoted that entire chapter giving us examples, referring to some by name and how they demonstrated their faith, and others by illustration, rather by the acts that they performed, the stopping of the mouths of lions, the quenching of fire, and so on, women receiving their dead to life again. It must be faith that Paul has in mind as this close-girding sin, or this sin which does so easily beset us. Now, there are some of the theologians, some of the commentaries who suggest something else, but I think the majority of them, and I think perhaps all of us, would agree that faith is what Paul has in mind, and how appropriately faith fits the lesson. He starts the 11th chapter by defining for us faith, and then devotes the entire chapter by recalling the experiences of faith of those, that class that we call the ancient worthies. Ancient worthies, I think that term derives from two things. First of all, the diaglot, in place of using the word elder, uses the word ancient, and Paul demonstrates by his writings their worthiness, and from that has been coined the expression, the ancient worthies. And as they had their tests of faith, and in most experiences met them with hearts of trust and confidence in God, so they serve well as witnesses for us, examples for us, for our encouragement and the strengthening of our faith. Now, Paul defines faith in Hebrews 11:1, and the King James reads, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." I don't know how that particular reading or translation appeals to you, but it's always been hard for me to appreciate it. I like the way J.B. Phillips translates it. You know, if you have a J.B. Phillips, and if you haven't read the preface or introduction that he has to his translation of the New Testament, you should read it sometime. He explains there very nicely the difference between translating and interpreting. And he points out that he, in his translation, felt that he made a fairly faithful translation. But on the other hand, there is always the danger, and it happens quite often, of the creeping in, as the translator works, his interpretation. He's bound to be influenced to some extent, no matter how faithful he may try in his translation to allow some of his own convictions to creep in. But here's how he translated Hebrews 12:1. "Now faith means putting our full confidence in the things we hope for. It means being certain of things we cannot see." Now let's change from the plural to the singular, the word things. "Now faith means putting our full confidence in the thing we hope for." And what do we hope for? Paul tells us in Ephesians that we are called in the one hope of our calling. And what is that hope? To share with our Lord in his glory, honor, and immortality. To be made partakers of the divine nature. Now, we dwell upon that so much that I think we overshadow and sort of seem to make that the important part of our hope. But you know, I think a much more important part of our hope is what we're going to be able to do because we are made partakers of the divine nature and because we have the fulfillment of this glory, this hope, and this immortality. The blessing of all the families of the earth as a part of the seed of Abraham under the terms of the new covenant and the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. It means being certain of things we cannot see. Paul says we walk by faith and not by sight. We're living in a time when we have much about us in the way of facts to tell us where we are in relation to the plan of God. And yet, it is still, on our part, a walk of faith. And it's not just faith in the plan, it's not just faith in the time that in the future there will be a kingdom, there will be a new covenant established, there will be the blessing of all the families of the earth, but it's a faith that carries us along each day. It's something that should be with most of us, if not all, by this time, so much a part of us that it doesn't have to be questioned. I hope that's the way it is with all of you. Paul goes on then, dropping down to the sixth verse, and he writes, "But without faith it is impossible to please him," that is, to please God, "for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him." I remember probably the first or second year that Sister Penrose and I were in the truth. We had our first pilgrim visitor. And to us it was just the same as the Lord coming to visit us. At that time we felt all the pilgrims and all the elders were just almost the Lord himself. Later on we found that they all had feet of clay also, as we all know. But I took the brother downtown, the little town we lived in at that time. He wanted to do some shopping. We rode around the square. This is a little city that had a square and courthouse in the center, looking for a place to park. Finally, second time around, there was a place to park. I pulled in and he said, "Thank you, Lord." And it suddenly dawned on me that he had faith that the Lord was going to provide a place for us to park so he could do his shopping. It's something that should be just so much a part of us that we don't have to really think about it. That we trust the Lord that he's going to bless us if we, and this is the part that's important in this verse, he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him, or let's say serve him. If we're serving the Lord, if we're striving to carry out our covenant of consecration, if we're serving the Lord in whatever capacity he has seen fit for us, whether it's speaking from the platform, whether it's just passing out tracts or witnessing at work, or whether it's a sister working in the home, Paul says we should do all things as unto the Lord. And without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So, dear brethren, let us, in our endeavors, during the remainder of this convention, when we leave the convention and face the experiences that await us, whatever they might be, let us see that we run this race with patience, patient endurance. Now, the two words do not go together in that, well, they can be separate in the sense that, let me put it this way. You can endure, but you can also endure impatiently. Have you ever heard, and how many of you mothers have ever said to your child when being a little bit noisy and irritating, "I've just about run out of patience with you. You've exercised patience up to a point, but it's just about at the end." So we can endure things, but sometimes we endure them impatiently. Now, how many times have you been stopped at a traffic light? The light turned green, you're a little slow to start up. Behind you, somebody hits the horn. "Let's get going." Or you may do that yourself. Yes, if we're going to endure, and we have to endure our experiences, let us endure them patiently and thus be pleasing to our Heavenly Father. Now, I want to close with some words from the Apostle Paul, written to the church at Philippi. You know, his letter to the Philippians was really a letter of friendship. He does not criticize. He does not find fault with them. But it was just a letter of love to those brethren there at Philippi. And I'm reading from the second chapter and the first four verses. And here again, by this time you'll know that I like J.B. Phillips, but I'm reading from J.B. Phillips' translation. And here's what he wrote. "Now, if your experience of Christ's encouragement and love means anything to you, if you have known something of the fellowship of his Spirit and all that it means in kindness and deep sympathy, do make my best hopes for you come true. Live together in harmony, live together in love, as though you had only one mind and one spirit between you. Never act from motives of rivalry or personal vanity, but in humility think more of one another than you do of yourselves. None of you should think only of his own affairs, but each should learn to see things from the other person's point of view. Now, the key sentence in those verses, I think, is this, and this is what I want to leave with you as my personal expression to you. Do make my best hopes for you come true. And that is that in time you each will be found worthy to hear those words, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joys of the Lord. And to do that, you must run this race with patience, patient endurance. And may the Lord bless our thoughts.